Stand together for the reading of God's holy word and turn to the book of Numbers, chapter 13. Numbers 13. All right, look there at verse 30. And Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it." But the men that went up with him said, "We be not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we." And they brought up an evil report of the land which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, "The land through which we have gone to search it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof. And all the people that we saw in it are men of a great stature. And there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants. And we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight." All right, let's pray.
The beginning point of our message tonight took place within a year of the Exodus from Egypt. This was the first generation, the generation that had come out of Egypt. They'd been slaves and had been delivered by Moses and were now on their way to the Promised Land. None of them had ever seen Canaan. Moses himself had not seen Canaan. They had been in Israel or in Egypt since Joseph brought Jacob down about 215 years prior, and no one alive had ever seen the Promised Land. Moses led them up from the south through the rocky desert country to the place called Kadesh Barnea, the gate to the Promised Land. And they stood there and they made a fatal decision. The title of my message tonight comes from one of my favorite hymns, "Canaan Land is Just in Sight." We're going to take three different views of Canaan at three different times from three different perspectives. Now, we have to understand that Canaan does not represent heaven. I love the song, "On Jordan's Stormy Banks I Stand," and it's a great song, but Canaan does not represent dying and going to heaven. Now, certainly, we can think of heaven as our promised land, but the promised land that Joshua and Israel were going into was a land where there were still enemies, there were still battles to be fought, there were still cities to be conquered. And folks, when we die and we go to heaven, there's no enemies where we're going. There's no battles where we're going. There's no warfare where we're going. And there's nothing left to conquer where we're going. And so it's not a picture of heaven. You know, Canaan was not the sweet by and by. Canaan represented the nasty now and now. But it also represents the victorious Christian life in the will of God. Now, the only alternative for the born-again Christian, I should say the only two alternatives for the born-again Christian are either to go into Canaan, the will of God for your life, or to wander in the wilderness under God's chastisement, because a born-again Christian can never really go back to Egypt. If you get saved, you can never, ever, ever go back to what you were before you got saved. You can't. You can never return to the place where you were before God saved you, because that would mean being an unsaved person again. And when a person is saved, they're saved forever, and nothing can ever change the fact. Listen, it was never an option to go back to Egypt. Now, they wanted to go back to Egypt, but God wouldn't let them go back to Egypt. It was not possible. And a Christian can never return to the exact same life they had before they got saved. If you're genuinely born again, you might go back to doing some worldly things like you used to, but you're not going to enjoy it like you used to. Because now someone lives inside of you, the Holy Spirit of God. Things are permanently different when you get saved. And so, the only options you have as a Christian are to go into Canaan and take the milk and honey that God has for you and to face your battles and to kill your giants. Or you can spend the rest of your life wandering around in a barren, hot, wasted desert life on bread and water under the chastisement of God with no victory, no success, no fruit, nothing to show for your life, and one day you'll die and some preacher will stand over your carcass and try to figure out something good to say. Well, I'll find something good to say. You know, sometimes preachers have to stand up and not say a bunch of things too. Because a lot of Christians, oh, they're saved, but their lives are wasted examples of the Christian life. Now, Moses and Israel came to this border of the promised land, and yet, as we're going to see in just a second, they did not go in. A Christian can be born again and yet live a dissatisfied, fruitless, unhappy, under conviction, no spiritual victory kind of a life, but that is not what God wants for you to have. By the way, you can go to church every Sunday for the rest of your life and still be carnal and worldly and not doing the will of God for your life. Now, tonight I want you to consider three views of Canaan at three different times from three different places and perspectives. Notice first in our text tonight, the faithless view. The faithless view. We read this a moment ago, but this was when Moses had sent the 12 spies into the promised land. Everyone's familiar with the story. But if you're not, some of you may not be, I'll give you a basic outline is that they went in, they visited the land of Canaan, they snuck around in there and they saw all the cities, and they came back bearing between them on a staff grapes the size of basketballs. And they had seen everything that God had for them. Listen, folks, the land of Canaan was not a desert land at that time. This was 3,000 years ago. Back then, the land of Israel was like the garden of God. That's how God described Sodom and Gomorrah before He turned it into a salt pit in the Dead Sea. Back then, it was a beautiful, lush, well-watered, it was the jewel of the earth, and God was going to give it to His people. You have to understand, over 3,000 years, empires have come in and cut all the trees down, turn it into a desert. But back then, it was a beautiful, lush, fertile place. And they came back with reports of all that they had seen, and that it was a land that did flow with milk and honey, and that there were grapes there, and it was the harvest time, and they were excited. But they also came back with a faithless report. They ruined it with that one faithless word, nevertheless. That's the language of the wilderness. Well, there's all this over there and it's amazing and it's everything God said it would be, nevertheless. And then when Caleb tried to argue on God's behalf, they said, but there's always one of those when someone's trying to do the will of God. They ruined it with that one faithless word. They said the people are strong. Well, are they stronger than God? They said the cities are walled. Was that a problem at Jericho? They said the cities are great. And they said that there's giants there. And they revealed their faithless attitude when they said, we are like grasshoppers in our sight and their sight. So there was a faithless view. Now thank God for Caleb. Caleb stood up in verse 30. Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it. In Numbers 14, God said about Caleb that he had another spirit with him and hath followed me fully. Caleb and Joshua alone of the 12 spies had a different spirit and walked in different steps than the rest of the spies. Caleb had the right spirit. He had a can-do attitude, not a no-way attitude. No one ever does anything for God with a can't-do-it attitude. Someone has to have enough faith to say, it can be done, we can do it, we can overcome this, and God can give us the victory. Caleb had a right spirit. Caleb had the right steps. God said that Caleb hath followed me wholly, fully, wholeheartedly. That Caleb was following and serving God. Boy, we need a revival of Christians who are not so half-hearted, half in, half out, lukewarm, on sometimes, off sometimes. A revival of genuinely faithful, involved, committed Christians. Hey folks, you want to be involved in this church? Show me that you want to be involved. I mean, show that you're wholly invested. Show me that you want to be part of what's going on. Caleb had the right steps. He had the right spirit. God said he has wholly followed me. I like Caleb, and I think I've said that before. I love Caleb. You know what his name means? I think I've mentioned this before. You know what his name means? Anyone remember? Brother Asher? His name means a dog. Now, I used to think that that was kind of a derogatory term. Maybe it was. But I don't think Caleb was any little poodle dog with pink fur. And I don't think Caleb was like one of these little chihuahua dogs. You know, we drove through the Chihuahua Desert last year and didn't see any wild chihuahuas running around. I can't tell you how disappointed I was. I expected to see packs of them running, you know, and nothing against chihuahua dogs. You know, now that I say that, I want to go eat at Taco Bell, but Caleb was, you know, I knocked on the door one time and the window had blinds. All of a sudden the blinds burst open and there's this little chihuahua, his eyes bugging out like this, his teeth bared, he's scratching at the window, and I can just hear him in his little Spanish accent. Come in here and I'll eat you alive. Now, you know why he was brave? Because there's glass between us. I don't think Caleb was part of that crowd that's always barking and never biting. You know why I like bigger dogs? We have a big dog. And sometimes people think I don't like dogs. I love dogs. I just don't think they're our children. And I took our dog down to the lake today. Took her all the way down. We have an old park with lake access. It's shut down now, so it's locked shut, but you can just go over the fence. And we walk down the old path. And so we walk through the tall grass all the way down there, down to the lake, around the lake. And you know, unfortunately, she found her way home, but I took her there. What I like about big dogs is little dogs always barking about everything. Bark, bark, bark. Big dogs only bark when they mean it. Little dog will run 10 feet around you, and all he's saying is, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you. And as soon as you get close, he goes back and back and back and back. Big dog, he comes at you, he's going to kill you. I like that. When I think of Caleb, if he was a dog, you know what kind of dog I think Caleb was? I think Caleb was one of these Marine military trained German Shepherd dogs. I mean, those dogs are awesome. I like German Shepherds. And these German Shepherds, I mean, they are trained. They will follow their master into combat. They will fight terrorists. They will destroy what is in front of them on a simple order. I think that was the kind of dog that Caleb was. And Caleb said, we can do this. Caleb said, we can take this. Caleb said, God is with us. And he said, we can do it now. There's no longer a need to delay. Let us go in immediately and take the promised land. Thank God for, you know, Caleb is a German Shepherd in a pack, a nation of Chihuahua dogs at that time. They're all afraid. Everyone's talking big. But no one wants to do what was necessary. But unfortunately, the faithless view won out. Sadly, many Christians are just like this crowd that missed their opportunity. They spend their lives in the wilderness. They're slaves to their lusts. Can of beer runs their life. Cigarette runs their life. Pornography runs their life. They won't break their addictions. They won't become faithful. They won't become consistent. They're slaves to selfishness. And they spend their lives under God's chastisement, and they never do the will of God for their lives. They spend their lives out in the wilderness because they're not willing to follow God wholly. When are we going to do the will of God? When are we going to stop putting it off and worrying about how hard it's going to be and just take the step up and face the giants and face the warriors and face the walls? Sooner or later, someone has to have enough faith to step forward and do what needs to be done. But you see the faithless view. Well, let's go to Deuteronomy 34. Deuteronomy chapter 34. We're going to fast forward about 39 years. Deuteronomy chapter 34, and we find Moses on his last day on earth. Deuteronomy 34 and verse number 1, we find, secondly, the fatal view. We saw the faithless view, now the fatal view. In chapter 34, verse 1, it says, Moses went up from the plains of Moab unto the mountain of Nebo to the top of Pisgah that is over against Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead unto Dan, and all Naphtali, and all the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, and all the land of Judah unto the utmost sea, and the south, and the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees unto Zoar. And I think God had to give him some pretty powerful binoculars to see all that. To stand on Mount Pisgah. You can't see all that with the natural eye. That's hundreds of miles. And yet God, you know, it's kind of like one of those things, if you ever go up on a skyscraper and they have those things where you can pay money and look into them. We went up to the top of the Sears Tower and they had these things up there. My wife says, oh, give me a dollar. I want to look through this. I said, honey, we were just down there. Why do you want to pay to look at it from up here? I mean, we're just down there. You could have looked around. Now we're up here. You want to pay to look through this thing. Why don't we just pay for it down there and look up at the skyscraper? And God allowed Moses to see everything. Saw all the promised land, all the way up in the north country, all the way to the sea, all the way in the south, all the way down into Jericho. Saw everything that was there, all the beauty of it. In verse 4, the Lord said unto him, this is the land which I swear unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it unto thy seed. I have caused thee to see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not go over thither. God allowed Moses to see it, but not experience it. Why? You remember why? Back in Numbers 20, God told Moses to, the people were complaining. It was a bad day. Moses' sister had just died, and the people were griping and complaining. And they were on Moses' last nerve. And they said, we're thirsty. And so Moses went out to the rock to get water, but God said, just speak to the rock, and the rock will give forth its water. The rock represents Christ. And Moses, in his anger, told the people of Israel, all right, you bunch of rebels, I'll give you some water. And he struck the rock twice with his staff. We understand from the New Testament that the rock was Christ. The rock that followed them was Christ. And so he's basically striking at God, striking at Christ. He didn't do what God said. He dishonored God. And you might not think that was a big deal, but to God it was a big deal. And because of that, God told Moses, you will never go in the promised land. Now you have to give Moses credit. For the next 39 years, he dealt with that backslidden, rebellious nation and did his job for God. And even at the end, he asked God again, please, change your mind. Allow me to go into the promised land. I mean, Moses wanted to see the promised land, but God said, don't even ask me about it again. You're not going in. Now, this is a sad point, but I believe this. That it is possible to forfeit the perfect will of God for your life. I mean that we can lose out on what God had for us. And we need to understand that one bad decision can have lifelong ramifications. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9, I run, I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection. Lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. In other words, Paul is serving God at this point in his life, and he's writing the Corinthians. He has all of the God's will left to do in his life. He has other things left to do for God in his life. But he said, I have to keep under myself, lest I sin in such a way that God has to put me aside, put me on the shelf, and become a castaway, and I never do all these things in the future that God intended for me to do because I gave into some temptation or because I made some dumb decision that caused me to be shelved, and I never did everything God wanted me to do. There are men who are called to pastor who will never pastor. Men called to the mission field who will never go to the mission field. Young people that could have been pure, they will never be pure again. Marriages that could have been great that will now no longer be great or not exist. Children that could have been raised for God. Churches that could have been started. Ministries that could have seen people saved. Be careful. Moses made a tragic mistake. Now God allowed him to see, but wouldn't allow him to go in. And that's a terrifying thought to me, but it's, you know, when God gives us a terrifying thought, it's for our warning. But I'm 39 years old. I expect to live out a full life, and I want to live for God, and I want to do everything God has for me to do. But I do not want to mess up when I'm 39 or 40 and spend the next 20 or 30 years of my life out of the will of God, never able to do what God intended for me to do. Christian, be careful and take heed to the fatal view that Moses had. Now, God killed Moses there in the mountain. God buried him also, so that those the people of Israel that tended toward idolatry would not make an idol out of his body. Now, the Bible is clear that Moses was not sick. In fact, he was 120 years old, and it says that his natural force had not abated. There was nothing wrong with him. You don't die unless there's something wrong with you. I don't know if because Moses had spent so much time in the presence of God that his life was extended. I don't know. But there was nothing wrong with him, and so God killed him. Now, how did God kill him? I heard Harold Seitler say, I think God just pulled him into his arms and hugged him to death. I heard another preacher say that God had told Moses that no man can see my face and live. And so on the mountain, God just said, here I am. And Moses died. But I want to take the warning from this that you don't want to have the fatal view. Be careful of your decisions. All right, number three, there's a faithful view. If you go over to one page there to Joshua chapter 1 and verse 1, it says, now after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass, the Lord spake unto Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' minister, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, thou and all this people, unto the land which I do give to them, even to the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, that have I given unto you, as I said unto Moses. Now, this is the new generation. This is the younger generation. Now, some of them were in their 50s. Some of them were pushing 60, but no one but Joshua and Caleb were over 60 because everyone over 20 had died 40 years before. And some of them, no doubt, had been born in the wilderness. And all the life they'd ever known was the wilderness, and all they'd ever eaten was bread and water, and now they're standing on the border of the promised land. And I tell you, that generation was ready to go over. They wanted what was there. They wanted it. Oh, there were some, though, however, that didn't. By the way, Caleb was ready. You know what Caleb did for 40 years? 500 push-ups every day. Because when he was 85, you know what he did? He went to Mount Hebron and conquered the giants. There's one tough old dude. You got to watch out for the tough old dudes. They know they can't last long, so they just kill you fast. I used to work out at the Rockwall YMCA, and there was this old man that'd come in. He looked like he was 85, and he limped. And he would come in and he'd get on the treadmill. I'm telling you, that old guy would go for an hour. I don't know if he was planning to conquer Canaan or not, but he was. I mean, I couldn't keep up with him. And so Caleb, I think Caleb had on the wall of his tent a little picture of a mountain. Little stick figure giants. They didn't have TV. I think every day he'd get up and look at that and say, I'm going to get that mountain. And kill those giants. And he'd do his 500 push-ups. You think he's hanging around with the other old folks in the wilderness? A bunch of griping, complaining, reprobates? No. He's out there doing push-ups. Working with us. But anyway, he was ready. Most of that generation was ready, but some did not want the promised land. There were some who chose to live on the eastern side of Jordan. And on the eastern side of Jordan. You know, when we talk about Israel today, you never hear on the news about the East Bank. You hear about the West Bank because everyone knows the western side of Jordan is the promised land. And yet these 2.5 tribes, they said, no, this is more convenient. This is what we want. This is more comfortable for us. And so they claim land on the other side of the promised land. And many Christians are content to live just outside the will of God. Just close enough, but not really involved. Not really in. It was a place of conformity to the world. It was a place of compromise. It was a place where they settled for less. They had not even seen the promised land, and yet they chose this side for themselves. You know what, folks? You can be close to the will of God, but being close is not being in the will of God. There's so many Bible examples for that. Remember Jacob? He was way off in Ur of the Chaldee, or way off in Mesopotamia. God told him to come back to Bethel. He stopped 20 miles away in Shechem. 20 miles from the will of God. God said, go to Bethel. He stopped in Shechem. Guess what happened? His daughter went out, saw the other teenage girls at the local high school. Fell in with their crowd. Got into a bad relationship with a young man there. The brothers got upset and killed all the men in the city. And Jacob has to deal with this horrendous situation in his life. But Jacob, maybe if you hadn't stopped 20 miles from the will of God, maybe you wouldn't be dealing with all the drama and problems in your life. Maybe if you were in the center of God's will for your life, things would have worked out differently. It matters that we're in the will of God and not just close to the will of God. Well, there was the rest of Israel, however, was ready for the western side, the promised land. And over there they found conquest and victory. And folks, there's going to be battles, but they're worth fighting. I wish I could tell you that in the church there's never going to be any trouble or any problems, but there's going to be problems in a church, any church. There's going to be problems in your life, there's going to be problems in my life, or that we have to conquer and get the victory. And there's no other way to deal with it except just to fight it out and to finish it off. There's conquest and victory. There was continual blessings. God said, my eyes are always on that land. He said, I'll send the rain. I'll bless. I will provide. It was a place of continual blessings. And it was a place where the captain was waiting. Boy, when they went across Jordan and they're under the shadow of Jericho, and Joshua is up one night. He's nervous. He's got the weight of the world on his shoulders. And he goes out in the middle of the night to walk close to the city and check out the city. And all of a sudden, there's a giant standing in front of him. Joshua had courage. He was ready to fight whoever it was, but who he was actually seeing was the Lord. The Lord said, take off your shoes. You're on holy ground. That was Jesus. And he was the captain of the Lord's host. Folks, I'm glad that I don't have to face the battles and the problems without a captain. But I'm not going to find him on the other side of Jordan. I got to find him close to the battlefield. And it's a wonderful thing to know that Christ is with us through all of our battles and our adversities and our problems. So three views of Canaan. Don't take the faithless view. Don't have the can't-do attitude. Have a can-do attitude. Don't make choices that will lead to a fatal view one day where you realize you're not going to ever do what God wanted you to do. And take the faithful view. Be like those who say, we're going to go over, we're going to do it, whatever God said. We're going to follow wherever Joshua leads. We're going to follow our captain. And we're going to see the victory no matter what it takes. That was the faithful view of Canaan. Guess who got to enjoy the milk and honey? Those who took the faithful view.